Welcome to We Are Libertarians for this week. You get two episodes this week. You are, I am generous and thorough.
You are quite generous and thorough, right, and you are unafraid of losing listeners, letting James Neese go unloaded all alone, just you two having a fireside chat.
I am your host, Chris Spangle. To my left is Greg Lenz. Greg, how are you?
Doing well, Chris. How are you?
I'm well. Brett Bittner joins us. Brett, how are you?
I'm doing quite well. It is almost the weekend.
I know. Well, I'm already done for the weekend. Put in my 4 hours. I'm ready to go. joining us is Chloe Anagnos.
Very good.
I said it right.
You said it correctly.
How Greek are you?
I am half Greek.
Okay.
Half Greek, half German. So right now it's a little interesting.
Oh my!
Especially in the.
Is there a war within yourself?
Just a little bit.
You're struggling with the greater jihad. Now, you. You said your name was what before your family changed it?
Before my grandpa changed it, it was Anagnostopoulos, which I believe is like 17 letters. So imagine that, like on a jersey, on the SAT. It's rough.
You'd get like 478 points, and you get 400 for spelling your name right. I learned that in Blue Chips.
Yeah, that's right. Nick Nolte approach to the SAT knowledge.
Right. You get 200 points for spelling your damn name right.
That's what he missed. He misspelled his name.
God damn it. I love hearing, I have a friend named Kostaki Economopoulos,
okay.
And like that's shortened. And I just love hearing Greek names said. Say your name again.
Chloe Anagnostopoulos.
Oh,
or Anagnos.
Awesome. Yeah. I'm so excited. That made my day. all right. So we know Brett.
Yeah. Now I need no introduction.
Brett, when I benevolently decided to leave my position at the Engelhardt Group and the Advocates for Self-Government as their marketing guy, I decided to troll the Engelhardt Group and the Advocates. And now I am trolling anyone who ever orders the quiz, because Brett, you have a new title with the Advocates for Self-Government.
The last time I was on, I think I had...
You had just title. Got it.
I forgot it. Say it again.
I'm the executive director for the Advocates for Self-Government. We've moved from Cartersville, Georgia to Indianapolis, Indiana.
Okay.
We're pretty excited to be in our new space.
Yeah, you're in downtown on Mass Ave.
Very trendy.
Right, very cool. Yeah, across from Brewburger.
Mm-hmm.
I feel it's just, I could feel the freedom lifting. It's just very free.
Oh, very freeing.
Smells like liberty.
Yes,
much better than that's not liberty.
now, Brett, you went on, and so Chloe, you moved up and you took Brett's job with the Engelhardt Group and in a roundabout way, the Advocates. It's really confusing.
It is kind of confusing. I know I took his office, if
right.
that helps.
My office.
How was the transition?
Your office.
That's my chair that I let Brett sit in, even after I left.
So I have your chair, your office.
Let me be benevolent again. You may have my office and chair now.
Oh, thank
you. It is now Chloe's.
I appreciate it.
Hear that, Brett?
Uh-huh.
The reason we wanted you on today is so we could not talk to Brett and talk to you instead,
okay.
First of all. Secondly, you've been with them for, what, 2 weeks?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you're not comfortable making fun of Brett yet. We want to help you get there.
Yeah.
Okay, we want to help
you. We're going to facilitate this process.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
So.
And I am fully deserving of all of it that I take.
So the following topics are okay to mock Brett on, okay? He's really bald.
I shave.
Well, yeah, you shave your head,
yeah.
So it's trendy. He's really bald. He likes pugs a little too much. That's number one. Number two.
The pug life, bruh.
Number three.
Man, you don't know. You don't know.
He's from Georgia, and that means he's racist. So, secondly, number four, anytime he pisses you off, just scream out, "Sherman did nothing wrong." That really makes him mad. And then he will go, "You know what? Sherman came through and he burned down my town. He burned down my grandma's house." He just gets real pissed off. It's very funny.
What's awesome about that is my family's not actually from the South.
Okay.
And we didn't come over until World War II.
Oh.
Oh, you fled?
Yes.
Fled from what?
The Nazis.
Oh, were you Britton Steinowitz?
This is awkward now.
A little bit.
What was that?
Britton Steinowitz? You shortened it to Bittner?
Close. No, we did have one change.
I really don't feel like you're telling me the truth right now.
No, it's absolutely the truth. We actually went back and looked at the genealogy, My grandfather was the first one who was born here in the States.
Oh, okay.
No kidding.
All and right. So he was the first Bittner here. He was born in Wisconsin. He went back to Europe. They had his brother, his sister, and the cousin whose parents were killed in front of him all lived together with my great-grandfather, Bruno, who had a cigar factory.
All I'm thinking of is Sacha Baron Cohen right now.
Not that Bruno.
Did he sit on Mexicans?
No, not that Bruno. But in the 30s, Bruno saw what was happening in Europe.
Oh, no, this is terrible.
LOL Holocaust.
We weren't quite there yet, but yeah, they ended up moving to the U.S.
So did he go back to the Weimar Republic?
No, they were in Poland at the time.
Oh.
But they were actually... The stories that I've had from my great aunt, they talked about the time that they were essentially homeless mm-hmm. in the mountains because they couldn't go to their house because it had been taken over by the Nazis.
Well, that's sad.
My grandfather was actually in a concentration camp for 2 years and was part of a prisoner of war exchange.
I'm going to cry now.
And after the war...
Now. Don't you feel bad for posting all those Hitler memes now, Greg? See?
No, because they're inspirational.
He spoke 6 languages, and he devoted the rest of his life to service to first the U.S. Army, the Army Air Corps, and then the Air Force.
It's amazing.
And he passed away in 1980, so I only had the first 9 months of my life to get to know him.
Right.
The only thing that I remember is that he could not say Snuffleupagus.
Oh, that's funny.
So you are Polish descent, or no?
German.
From the Black Forest. Look at him. He's swarthy.
We still have family in Germany and in Poland, but for the most part, the direct link was through Poland.
Gotcha.
And interestingly enough, I believe Poland just requested permanent NATO troops, basically U.S. troops.
Really?
They just, Putin, given the history of Russia's expansionism, is a little bit worried, and so they would like that in the weapons system.
I don't blame them at all.
No, their history is invasion, so right. I would want as many U.S. troops as possible right on the border.
Like, I have a friend who lives in Finland, and she's like, they're scared shitless. They're just pooping their pants all the time. At any moment, the Ruskies are coming in, and then Belgium is next, and then we won't have chocolate.
Well, the good news is we know that France will immediately wave the white flag once... Somebody
has
some
to be the
cheese-eating
surrender monkeys there in the European world.
Greg, your family was in a concentration camp, right?
Mine?
Yeah, fell out of the guard tower.
Oh, that's brutal.
Thank you. No, Greg's new favorite pastime on Facebook is taking inspirational quotes.
Like Gandhi and very uplifting individuals and putting them on Hitler faces. Because Chris's new pastime is to put
encourage people.
But I support that decision, and I think that's a
wonderful
thing.
And I'm always
thing.
Sending Chris good vibes.
I know.
I'm going through a change in my life. I'm going through either a mental breakdown or a spiritual awakening. I'm not sure which.
Yeah, it's a spiritual awakening.
And so I'm sharing,
I think it's a mix of both.
Yeah.
I'm sharing what I'm learning, and Greg, every time I post something to inspire the people, post a photo of Hi Blair, a photo of. An inspirational quote over a picture of Hitler.
And it's very funny. You know, it's like, be the change you want to see in the world next to Hitler's face.
Blair, give the microphone to Blair. We got to talk to...
It's always good to play the Hitler card.
Yeah.
Hello.
Hi. How are you?
I'm wonderful.
This is Blair. Blair Engelhart, my former boss. Political hack here in Indiana.
Much skullduggery.
Much skullduggery, yes. Always up to some...
And thuggery.
And shenanigans. Can't forget the shenanigans. Are you eating on the air right now?
Yes. Yes. And this is unbelievable.
I know. It's really good.
I mean, this is like really good. And she went above and beyond herself on this one. Of course, I did give her the blueberries.
Right. He's talking about blueberry turnovers that...
So what are we talking about libertarian today?
We were talking about Hitler. Thoughts? No, we're talking about...
I took it on a tangent because they were talking about family history, and I actually provided them with some of mine, and somehow we got to Hitler. It was my grandfather being in concentration camp, I think, is what took us there.
Yeah. Right.
All I know is I've never used that in any commercials. That good. Word in any commercials.
How's Chloe doing?
So far, so good.
Yeah?
Yeah. She was in the studio this morning. And doing quite well, so.
So you make political commercials
sometimes,
for a living,
correct.
Yeah. So when you make a political commercial, this audience, they're political people, but they're not in politics. What goes into making a political ad?
Well, I mean, it depends if they've been in office or haven't been in office. We work a lot of times with people who have never run for office before, so we're dealing with complete political idiots. I mean,
right.
Literally starting from what color do you like, you know.
He's not. Why are you laughing? He's telling the truth.
The first question is that I always ask a client is, how's things at home?
Right.
Because there's nothing, guys, that'll ruin a relationship faster than running for an office.
Even I have seen the strongest marriages of 20 years really like on the brink of divorce after a one-year campaign.
If it's your brutal. Spouse or whatever, your other person, whatever, if they're not buying into it, you can hang it up now, because this, if you do it right, it takes all your time.
So libertarians, a lot of times, libertarian candidates think, oh, well, I don't know anything. And I constantly am saying Republican and Democratic candidates don't know anything when they start running for office either. Back me up on that, please.
Exactly. And most of them don't have a team behind them. I mean, once they get going, but they're all idiots to start off with. I mean, you know, libertarians, they're no different. They just don't have the structure.
Right.
Of the major parties behind them to help them if they're weak candidates.
Right.
So, you know, or the money.
Well, could you please try to behave yourself?
I will. I'm going to hand this back to Chloe.
Please,
now.
Please leave Chloe alone.
Guys, have a nice evening.
All right, see you, Blair.
Blair, thanks for blessing us with your presence.
Blair is the one who hired me, hired Brett, hired Chloe. Lots of Blair Englehart stories that we shared before we started the podcast. Really good dude. So if you're in the Indianapolis area and you're going to run for office and you want political ads or campaign stuff,
have your favorite color ready and have it worked out with your spouse.
And don't be an idiot.
Yeah.
Stop by the Englehart group and say hi. Greg, we have to address accusations. Chloe, there are no accusations against you from James Neese, but these two.
They're coming.
Oh, yes.
Just kidding. You're fine.
Okay.
You have your media firestorm heading your way with James Neese.
If you get a friend request from James Neese, you delete.
Isn't it James Brutalist Overlord Neese?
No, it's Brutalist Overlord James Neese, yes. James is, if you listen to the last episode, 121, with James Neese, titled Hulu and Chill with James Neese. Because he walks in, he sits down, and he goes, bruh. That's how he talks, Chloe. Bruh. You're losing so much weight. You're looking good, man. You're like 20 minutes from Netflix and chill, dog. And then, like, somehow, and then I brought it up on air, and he goes, no. I can't afford Netflix. And I said, you can't afford Netflix? He goes, I got Hulu, dog. Hulu and chill. I said, what happens after 20 minutes of Hulu and chill? And he goes, you start smoking crack. But it's such a simple concept, because I've never heard anybody talk about Netflix. Are you familiar with Netflix and Chill, Chloe?
I have the Netflix.
Okay, all right.
The Netflix.
But Netflix, yes.
Netflix and Chill is a very, it's a delicate situation. But have you, Greg.
Why did I get, wait a second, why did I get skipped?
Because you've been with Crystal like 10 years. You haven't Netflix and chilled in 8 years at least.
We were just watching... Never mind.
You invite a young lady over to your, I don't even know where you live, an apartment, a condo.
A house.
A
tent.
You turn on Netflix, and after 20 minutes, you look over, and you make your move.
I'm not a big participator in Netflix and chill because I find it boring.
Okay.
And I feel like it's like adding to the scumbag douchebaggery of the millennial generation of the constant like, yeah, we're just going to group hang. Or you know what I mean? Like,
right.
And I'm like, that's so boring.
Right.
Why wouldn't you go out?
You go skydiving,
Or you just go out, like go out and have fun, you know.
So,
like,
and then
I refuse to participate in the Netflix and chill movement or James Neese's
Hulu and chill.
God, that's like the EBT of the date world, you know. Like you literally are going so far. You're not even paying to not have commercials. That's how cheap you are.
He wanted to know if last night. Why you weren't there, why you didn't show up. But I'll get to that. Hold on. I'll get to that. But it's such a simple idea, like this meme that's going around of Netflix and chill. I've never seen anybody do Hulu and chill. Again, he's
an innovator.
He's an insane genius. He started Parallel Mexicans.
He did.
Because everybody just thinks they're all Mexicans, but all these countries are just parallel to Mexico, so they're not Puerto Ricans, they're parallel Mexicans. It's a joy to see somebody hear that for the first time in their life.
That's pretty funny.
It is very funny.
And then so I came up with Amazon Prime and chillin'. He goes, no dog, there's no chillin' if you got Amazon Prime. So he goes, why? Where's Greg dog? Where's he at? Where's he at a golf tournament? Is he hitting Titleist balls out at the range? He's got a backward hat on. And and I said, well, we didn't think that you'd show up because every time we invite you over, you're 2 hours late. And it turns out James was 30 minutes early to the podcast that we tried to cancel.
Well, yeah, you had sent me a message and you had texted him and it said no. Like, he basically just said no, right?
No, it was a wrong number.
Oh,
wrong number.
Okay,
and they just said
that
wrong
makes sense.
Wrong no.
Okay, gotcha. So that's why I just ended up making.
I can't
plans.
Believe that James doesn't have the same cell phone he had a year and a half ago.
I wonder if it's an Obama phone.
Just seems like James doesn't have his life together.
No, and the fact that he's responsible for like three different corporations, IT.
Really? Yeah.
Four is stunning.
I found out in that he runs three IT, four IT things. He has. Like, he does charity work on the side, mm-hmm. he does political work, and he owns his own company.
Oh, he's a highly competent individual. He just is highly competent on the interwebs.
And looks like a wood nymph.
He does resemble a wood nymph because he wears the knitted hats that hang right off the back of your head, you know? And he's always got, like, a 72-ounce, like, gas station drink of Mountain Dew with him at all times.
At all times. He is always drinking a big gulp.
And he drives a Saddam mobile, like an 80s Mercedes that's a champagne color. I'm shocked he's single.
All right, everybody be quiet. Let's hear Chloe's reaction the first time she sees him.
He seems nice.
Oh, boy.
She is so sweet. You are just so nice.
No, he looks like a nice person.
He is. He's a really nice kid.
That is a total... Wow, that is the only time I've ever heard that about James Neese.
Rebecca Johnson from high school, do you remember her?
Uh-huh.
She wrote, I think that's my IT guy. And I said, it is.
It is.
It is. It's her IT guy.
He's a wood nymph.
It's James. He does. He wears like the little hat and he just looks like a little nymph in a tree. And he's hanging out with fairies. He's like, yo, dog. Hey, fairy, what's up?
Well, he goes to, they throw fire frisbee. Or like they do like some dance it's a Broad Ripple Park. And it's like 2 a.m. on like a Tuesday night. And he goes to it because they bring like Indian food or whatever. And it's a bunch of homeless people. And it'll be out there like over by the Indianapolis Arts facility or whatever. And he's out there and they're throwing like flaming Frisbees or whatever up in the air. And it looks like some kind of seance. Like it is the And so, I mean, he literally is a tree person. Like he lives amongst.
He was talking about in Frankfurt going over to the Rural King on a Friday night where they hang out. And... He was doing outreach for libertarianism to all these guys who had giant trucks with the Confederate flags on the back, and they were doing chew, and they're like, "Nah, man, I hate fags. I can't vote for them." Like, and I was like, well, "You went up and talked to them?" He's like, "Yeah, dog. I gotta go up and like, I mean, I just don't. I'm not afraid to talk to people."
Yeah, well, he's a political candidate.
We ended up talking about outreach and everything, but he did so because we tried to cancel it. He began, I will ask him the question that he poses to you.
Mm-hmm.
Where is Greg Lenz? He's been talking to this girl, dog. Is he out smashing?
How would he know that?
Apparently his daily schedule, as covered in the last podcast.
He does message
with
me
a solid 4 hours of Brazzers. he said from noon to 1 every day he talks to you about quote-unquote some bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that you have been taking out a young lady, and he wanted to know if you were smashing.
We went out last night.
Nice. You didn't answer the question.
I'm not answering that question.
So, James, I guess you'll just have to message him to get your answer. And then we move over to Brett Bittner because of the rap beef. There's a rap beef between you and him.
It's East Coast, West Coast, dude.
I know. Well, were you even aware that you had a rap beef
no,
with James Neese?
No, I was completely unaware until I saw it in chat earlier today.
He goes, I edited this part out, but I'll say it now to your face.
Excellent.
Like a gentleman. He goes, I like Brett Bittner. He seems like a nice guy, but he's kind of a dick. He goes, he won't let me do the database or something. Apparently, you guys got into a fight. About databases. Apparently, right. It's a rap beef, man. You all saw right. Straight Outta Compton yesterday.
I did. I saw Straight Outta Compton last night. Right. I don't remember anything about databases, though.
Okay. So he can do a database in...
I mean, in the movie. I know vaguely what Chris is talking about. He's talking,
okay, I was like,
there were
no databases
in Straight Outta Compton. No.
Are you telling me that they don't do database administration in Straight Outta Compton?
There wasn't Microsoft Access anywhere in there. They're buying...
Not that I could tell, no.
They're buying ad time for everything. Why not
Shug
Access?
Shug ran such a tight ship. It might have been there, but it could have been just ending up on the editing floor.
Okay. And his complaint... I'll turn this into a productive discussion.
Excellent.
I don't know if there was a mediator between Biggie and Tupac. It certainly wasn't Suge.
They were not in Straight. Well, Tupac
I don't,
was.
It, clearly, was after yesterday's leak, it was not Jay-Z, and I know it wasn't Puffy. I'm not Puffy, okay?
Okay.
But I want to bring peace to this.
All okay? right.
Because I don't want to see you get shot.
It is definitely a possibility later today.
You better be nice to Chloe. She looks like the kind of gal that carries a gun in her purse. She works for a libertarian organization, right?
Hey.
You never know. I'm just saying, I'm not fucking with Chloe.
I can neither confirm nor deny.
She's thug life. So
she's as thug life as I am pug life.
Okay, stop that. I dropped my bottle because I was so stunned with how awful that was. Now, his complaint... is that the Libertarian Party is as bureaucratic as the other parties, and it is tough to get things done. Things that could take him a day to get done go through a committee that takes months to push through.
Yes.
And that is annoying to James, because why not just have it get done instead of deliberating for years and then things never getting done?
You mean like the last 2 years that I spent working on the Libertarian National Committee to change the logo?
Correct.
And
you and I...
The guy who understands that committees are where action goes to die.
Exactly right.
I was the first one credited with that quote. I totally understand where James is coming from.
Sure.
And
well, this is not going well. You're not beefing right.
Oh, sorry.
I totally understand where my opponent is coming from. That's like the worst rat beef of all time.
I know. Well, it's because I guess I'm not as ATL as I thought I was.
I guess not.
To answer your question, I totally understand. I'm right there with you. I've been through the bureaucratic nonsense. It exists in every organization, but not everybody can move at the speed of an individual.
Sure.
It took me forever in my effort to change the logo for the National Party. I met with Will Taylor, the designer, the end of 2013. It's now 2015 when we'll see it implemented. And it just took a while to go through, and all the machinations and all the committees and all the people who want to have input here and there and everywhere. And it's one thing to say, hey, I can do this, but there are a lot of things to consider. Are you going to send voter data, member data to somebody that no one really knows? Are you going to authorize that kind of a thing? Because you have a... You have a duty to protect your member data from being used for unauthorized purposes. Mm-hmm. And that's probably the biggest thing that I would say is standing in the way of what he's wanting to do. The people who are coming out and saying, hey, whoa, slow down. It's fine and dandy that you want to do this. And this actually all started because I see the way that something is happening and moving toward on the national committee that will sprinkle down. It will, you know, we're talking about something that will come from the top.
Trickle down.
A shower, if you will.
Oh, God.
But
a libertarian shower.
But seeing that that's happening.
Gold.
I suggested to my local libertarian leadership that we should go ahead and get on board and be able to hit the ground running when National finally comes to a decision.
Sure.
So that's all it is. And I said, this is what I see happening. I can't do anything about it because I'm not on the committee. I can see what happens when we vote on it and talk about it in Orlando in November. But for me, I'm not going to put myself in the middle of that because I'm not on the committee. I'm just the alternate for Indiana, Michigan, Ohio, and Kentucky. I'm just forward thinking and want my local libertarians to be ready to hit the ground running when that decision is made.
Sure. Now, and we'll ask Chloe about her time in student government, because it's all the same thing.
Yep.
It's always, anytime you work with a board, boards are the worst. And you know, we talked.
Hang on. There are some really good boards.
I know you work for a board, and you love that board. Chloe does too, very much. Me, I'm not a board person anymore. That's for sure. Although the Advocates board is a great board. Should I want to take your job? Now
back.
I'm. is Indian Giver politically correct anymore?
Native American Giver.
Okay.
Yeah.
I ask you because you
I'm know. The I'm the PC overlord. The James is the brutalist overlord. Right. I'm the political correctness overlord.
Captain Hitler.
So
over
you
here.
Are 180 degrees opposite Donald Trump.
Exactly. I am deeply offended by bleeding wherevers. That has always been something I've never wanted to talk about because it's so offensive towards women. Let's see. Rosie O'Donnell is not a fat pig. She is an obese swine.
She's a lovely woman. Stop.
Oh, yes. Rosie and her 9/11 truth movement that
really?
She's on. Oh, her and Roseanne.
I didn't know she was a truther.
Oh. I thought Donald Trump was too, though, isn't he?
No.
No,
he just wanted
he's a
to build the new ones.
Oh, okay.
And he's a birther.
He wanted to make it huge.
Actually, his plans were awesome. I actually saw his. They were, and he was $400 million cheaper than the people they awarded it to.
Right.
I guess he didn't make enough donations to the people that were making the decision to get.
He didn't give Bloomberg enough money because him and Mike have beef.
Yeah. Now, boards, as we discussed on the last episode a little bit, and basically I summed it up, you can have great boards. You can have the definition of a great board is like the Advocates, where they set. The direction, they hire good people, and then they trust those good people to move in that direction and then hold them accountable when they don't. A bad board is the Libertarian National Committee, where they don't allow their staff to do anything. Everything has to be voted by decree, and people don't they take forever to answer their emails. It's very slow. It's very cumbersome. It's very political, and very little gets done. And then nobody can figure out why nobody wants to donate to the National Libertarian Party. It's, you know, it and why membership is dropping. It's because it's an ineffective organization. So I think that we have a lot of listeners who are involved in their local Libertarian Party, or they want to get involved in the National Libertarian Movement, and they want to get involved in organizations, or maybe we have Republican and Democratic listeners, and we've never really talked about bureaucracy and how to handle the bureaucratic bullcrap that we run up against.
Lots of patience.
I said bullcrap because I don't know if Chloe's offended by cursing. She seems like
a
nice girl.
It's fine.
Okay. She has cable. She reminds us every day.
Yeah, I have cable, HBO. Like, right. I hear it. It's fine.
Okay, good. All right.
She cable and chills.
Are you Lifetime and Chill?
Yeah, Lifetime and Chill. Lifetime
if
and
there's chill. A good, you know, Lifetime original movie on,
good.
Then, oh, yeah.
All right. Now, You have experience with student government.
Okay, yeah, a little bit.
Right. You give us your background in student government.
Sure. So I actually just graduated from Ball State in May. I was involved in student government for 3 years. Was the president my junior year, ran a campaign when I was a senior. So basically the entire time I was there, I was really involved. And I think that my board, particularly for the 2013-2014 school year, was very effective, but it was one of those things where it was you guys are students, so sure, you can go ahead and do some of this stuff, but we're the administrators and the faculty here, and we'll let you know what you actually can and cannot do.
Right.
So red tape.
A few crumbs tossed to the students on the campus.
Right. A little
where you might get an extra Diet Coke button on the soda machine.
It's funny you bring that up, Chloe. I don't know if you know this about me, but I was fifth grade student council president at Brentwood Elementary School. I beat Brad Patterson, the most popular kid in our class, and Jamie Mooney.
Wow.
Jamie Mooney, my first love, who was dating Brad Patterson. I beat both of them.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
And you probably got more votes than I did when I ran for school board.
I did that by promising vending machines.
You Bernie Sanders'd him.
I totally lied. I didn't lie. I thought I could do it. I thought I had, even at fifth grade, I had such confidence. I could talk the administration into getting us vending machines. And then Mrs. Bennett, bless her heart, came over to me and said, you know, we're never going to put vending machines. You should probably stop saying that and getting everybody riled up. And I said, well, they don't
know
that.
The establishment holding you down.
I know. Mrs. Bennett, I loved. Nobody else liked Mrs. Bennett, but I liked Mrs. Bennett. Mrs. Bennett was a diehard vice chair of the county Republican Party. I got involved in politics. She was so thrilled with me. Then I joined the Libertarians, and then now she's like, what's wrong with him? He's lost his way. He needs to come back to Reagan and Jesus. Now, so I, too, know what it's like to be held back by the administration. So
the man.
The man.
The man, if right. you will.
So it that administration is one force. There's always multiple forces that hold back a board and hold back what you can actually do. So what does student government do? Because I went to IUPUI, so that's not like a real college. That's where you go when your dreams have died in 10th grade.
Sure. Now, well, at my real college at Ball State, no, I'm just kidding.
How dare you.
Just blowing you smoke. I think probably one of the biggest things that student government has done, at least in the last 6 years, is what's called the Blue Loop, which is a bus route that goes off campus, kind of down Fraternity Row and into where, like, you know, you're a junior, senior, and you want to rent a house off campus, but you still want to be close enough to walk every day.
Right.
That's down by, like, Dill Street?
Yeah, yeah. So, like, Dill Street, Neely, which is known for, like, crazy parties and things, we actually funded and started up that bus. So that runs from Thanksgiving break until spring break, and it's really nice because especially these last few terrible winters that we've had, students aren't, like, dying while sure. they're trying to walk to class. So that's one of the biggest things that we've done.
So it's advocating for a better student life.
Yeah, better student life, and then also co-sponsorship. So let's say you are, I don't know, some other student organization and you want to bring a speaker onto campus. You can't necessarily pay the fees. You come to student government and say, hey, we need $1,000 because we really want this speaker. Can you co-sponsor?
So you ran Tammany Hall of Ball State. You were like Boss Tweed. You were handing out favors.
A little bit.
Look at you working deals.
A little bit.
You're like Donald Trump.
And this is all happening in the Northeast Corn Maze, right?
Right.
Yes, Northeast Corn Maze.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah,
Muncie, Indiana.
Have you never, you've never been like out there?
No, the furthest I've ventured into the Northeast Corn Maze is Anderson.
Oh, wow.
So about halfway.
I'll tell you what, I have had some of the most fun nights I've ever had at Dill Street Pub.
Did you smash?
it is an awesome place. Like, it is a great place to go out and have a good time.
It is fun.
Mm-hmm. So it's not just a corn maze. There are many, many fun things to do because Dill Street Pub had shut down and then yes. I believe reopened.
And now it's closed again.
It's closed again. Dill and Street's so no crab again. Racing?
No crab races, none of that.
Very See, here it's an injustice. You built it up, and I can't even go.
I know, I can't even take you now.
Man.
I was telling Brett yesterday, actually, that Ball State, we've lost a lot of bars in the village. I think right now we only have like three. Many because of like lawsuits and like one bar wasn't able to pay someone that got hurt on that property. So they had just, you know, shut down.
Social Did the nightclub shut down?
Yeah.
It shut down?
Mm-hmm.
Dang.
Aww. It's all gone.
It's a piece of your childhood.
I had a blast at that
And
nightclub.
By a piece of your childhood, I mean, you know, 2 years ago.
I got patted down.
Really?
Uh-huh, going into a nightclub, but for cowboy boots, shockingly.
Why were you wearing cowboy boots?
It was the last place that was open. I was out with friends. She had just graduated from speech pathology school.
Right.
And so we'd gone out, and all the bars shut down at 2, except this nightclub stayed up until 3.
Can you phonetically spell out, did you smash?
Anyway, we went out, and it was hood. Like, it was a place James Neese would hang out. And because I had just had, like, cowboy boots and jeans and a button-up shirt on, I was patted down and no one else was.
No pastel button-up shirt.
I did not wear the Oxfords or
deck shoes.
Yeah.
He's like, no wonder that Greg loves Charleston. It's all Greg Lynn's there. That was a great story. If you haven't listened to the James Need Post... I think I had like what were your brain
word salad?
I had apoplexy. Right there, word salad. That was a great story of James Neese in Charleston. I think that was the trip that he took where he went dumpster diving.
That was Florida.
Florida, okay. No, I think it was the same. He drove up.
Yeah.
This kid went and dumped. It's exactly what you think it is. You can laugh into the microphone.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, please. So, we'd prefer that you did. He survived on a trip. He took no money with him. He just ate out of trash the whole time.
All right.
Hey, whatever floats your boat.
Are you single? Because James is single. I can hook you up with James.
I am not.
Oh, that's Sorry. Too bad.
Darn the luck.
Quit lying. All right.
So at Ball State, was there a student libertarian party or Young Americans for Liberty?
Okay, good question, because I actually had a guy in a political science class that I took that said he was part of like a Young Students for Liberty group.
SFL?
Like, sure, like they were the libertarian group. Mm-hmm. But I think what had happened was... so many people graduated one year that the club just kind of ceased to exist. So they were there for a while. And then, you know, like when you have older people that are really involved, they graduate.
It just falls off the line.
Yeah, if you don't have a good succession plan, it never works out.
Yeah.
Happened at every university. Yep. IUPUI, IU, Purdue, all were really active, and then now they're not.
Yeah, I mean, Young Americans for Liberty all the way up until last year, which was the first event I met Brett at, and we went out with after the David Friedman.
Ah, yes.
Good old David Friedman.
At the, what was it? Were we at the Eagle's Nest, or were we at the...
It was no.
It was the top of the One America building.
Yeah.
Yeah, that club.
That little Skyline bar. Club.
Skyline yes. Club. Skyline. And we went there, and David Friedman was hitting on all the 19-year-old women.
You know who Milton Friedman is?
Name sounds familiar.
Yeah, Milton Friedman's the Chicago economist who brought Free to Choose, a lot of school choice. Very popular economist. His son David, less popular, more interested in the ladies than he is good economics. And if he were here, he'd sit really close to you. He'd sit next to you, and he'd tap one shoulder and he'd go, "Do you keep your parrot on this shoulder?
On
this shoulder, exactly. See?
Yeah, I know that one.
Yeah.
Was it a libertarian that did that to you?
Yes.
No, I think I have no idea. Probably just like a really bad date once. Right. I don't know. Blocked it out of my mind.
So it sounds like your student government experience wasn't as frustrating as these two's experiences have been with bureaucracy.
I mean, at the same time, I think when you're a student, you kind of have to understand, like, hey, you're a student, you're only going to be here for a few years, and the administrator that's been here for 20 probably knows better about what you can and cannot do with the food in the food court, so you should probably listen to them and do your research ahead of time. So I think my board was very effective. Now, the year afterwards, I don't think they were effective at all.
Sure.
But I think that just kind of happens.
She just did three snaps in the form of a Z, by the way. You didn't see that on the radio. Yeah, but
yeah. I saw it.
It was in her eyes, man. This sweet little Chloe's ready to cut some bitches. Yeah, and that's the problem. That's one of the problems with the board. You do great work in an organization, and then you hand it over to the next leadership and pray that they continue your good work. And most of the time, I mean, I know when you left the Libertarian Party of Georgia, I gave you some advice that you said was really helpful. Don't look back. Like, mm-hmm. as soon as you walk away from that organization, and if you are involved in an organization or management or leadership in any form of a campaign, of a county party, when you decide to quit, quit. Or if you're attached to your work, everywhere I've worked, I've been attached to my work. It's deeply personal.
Yep.
And so when I leave my deeply personal work and hand it over to somebody else, my impulse is to go, oh, you're screwing that up. That's why we did it this way. You know, you want to get controlling about it, and it's not your responsibility anymore. So you've got to just kind of walk away from it. And if it falls apart, it falls apart. And that's, you know, you move on to the next phase of your life. I think that's an important lesson that I learned, you know, if you stay involved, you know, like when Tim McGuire, I think he's been on the podcast, when he ran the Marion County Libertarian Party, he did a great job. And then when he stepped down, he stepped down and he stayed involved. And he didn't have the attachment to the work that maybe I have had on some things in the past. But
and so that sort of ties into what we kind of wanted to talk about today as far as, you know, effective libertarianism, which is something Brett works on a daily basis, and you used to work on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm. I'm not about that life anymore.
No, you are retired on your sabbatical from libertarianism.
Life.
From life in general. And, you know, that's what's so frustrating is, like, with James wanting to do the database thing, or you wanting to make change but knowing that the bureaucracy is going to outlive your term. It's where do you find your role? What role do you best fit? Mm-hmm. That's huge in the bureaucracy, and how can you do it to your most effective ability rather than the ability of personally satisfying?
I think it first starts, and James and I talked about this yesterday, when it comes to outreach, because James does a lot of great outreach. It's just different outreach than what most people would do, and what a lot of leadership would say, we don't want James being our representative, but James is unafraid. Like, James doesn't have fear to go out and talk to people. And I think so much of outreach and political action and really everything that leads to success in life is about knowing your core values, knowing who you are, being unafraid to speak, being authentic in what your goals are, not trying to be manipulative, not trying to be controlling or awful, and setting appropriate boundaries and goals and not saying, you know, I'm going to run for governor of Indiana as an independent and I'm going to win and there's nothing that can stop me. I mean, because the people that showed up to run for office as libertarians, and you want to win. That's the goal. The goal in politics is to win your election. But you also have to have realistic goals. So maybe winning number one, adding 2 percentage points number two.
Yeah, and anytime you know? Your goal is external and something you don't have concrete, you know, absolute control over, right. It's, you know, if that's that, I would tell anyone that that is their goal going in. That's a bad goal to have. If you look at the campaign of Andy Horning for Senate campaign, when Richard Murdoch laid the largest egg that's ever been laid by a Republican senator or Senate candidate in history, he did an incredible job of not whatever when that happened and Richard Murdoch said, you know, made the logical conclusion that if, you know, rape is part of God's plan, that was what he alluded to. Andy didn't bury him.
Which is really like even like you think bleeding out of your whatever is bad, but
yeah, and that's something Rick Santorum's battled too. I mean, anyone that doesn't believe in the rape or abortion exception fights that, and they use it's part of God's plan to defend that position, is that's what you run into. But Andy, literally in my parents' neighborhood, who are lifelong Republicans in a donut county, they were so open to Andy's message because Andy handled it so well. He showed extreme class in saying, you know, coming to Richard Murdoch's defense and not doing what the Democrat was so willing to do, because the Democrat was probably going to win at that point anyway. Richard just wasn't a great candidate, but when the Democrats just seized all over him, they looked so bad. They looked like vultures.
Right.
And Andy, by having that opportunity come up and presenting himself so well, he won so many Republicans that were a little bit disenfranchised and no longer really identifying with the hardcore tack of the Christian conservative wing of the Indiana Republican Party. I mean, he's got people that now are considering Rand Paul as their nominee in the Republican primary.
Yeah, because what Andy said is, I know Richard Murdoch. I don't know him well. I just know on our exchanges, but he seems like a very nice man who made a mistake, and he's a human being, and we all make mistakes. And if you want to vote for him or not vote for him based on that one gaffe, then that is your choice. I would much rather you look at me and what I stand for, but I don't think that we should vilify a guy because he said something in an environment that is very nerve-wracking. It is very, very intense to do a debate. And I think by doing that, by showing humanity, showing that he's a good person, because Andy's a great person, that he ended up getting a lot more votes. So I think the first step in being successful at outreach and libertarianism, in connecting with people, you have to be able to know how to connect with people.
Absolutely.
And if your personal relationships are a mess, you're probably not going to be great at connecting with perfect strangers, you know. And I think you have to really work on yourself and know yourself and have self-confidence and not be insecure. Everybody has insecurities, but if you're walking up and I'm walking up to you at an outreach booth and my every thought in my head and every fiber in my body is going, I'm going to make a fool of myself and this person's going to judge me and they're not going to like me, you're probably not going to make a great connection.
No. You know, when you're reaching out, the most important thing to me is to be genuine and honest. Second to that, I would say be really nice. That's one of the things that we see in the political sphere that really isn't around anymore. Everything is about scoring a political point, having that bumper sticker slogan that you're just going to use over and over and over again. But at the end of the day, we're all people. We all want to have a meaningful connection with other people. There are a couple people that want to live in a bunker, you know, in the middle of the desert. But for the most part, I think that people want to have a genuine connection with somebody. And if you aren't able to make that genuine connection, it's very difficult for you to be persuasive and to have to open somebody's heart and mind to something that they may have never considered before. And if you're not doing it in a nice way, you're certainly going to turn people off, or the majority of people off. And you know, the way that I look at it is I'm looking at how the majority of people are going to accept something.
Yeah. Smash.
But I know that there are people that are totally cool with the libertarian macho flash. You know, there's a whole movement.
Explain that.
Okay, so the libertarian macho flash is something that Michael Cloud talked about in Secrets of Liberty of Political Persuasion. And it's where you basically take the most extreme stance that you can, and that's what you lead with. So his example was at a dinner party, and this is on his audio tapes, which I have actually listened to more than once, but where he talked about someone attending a dinner party, and part of the conversation turned political, and the person there said, "Oh, we're going to talk about politics?" And he says, "F the state." That was the lead-in for seven people at the table who'd never met a libertarian before. That was their first impression of a libertarian. And so because...
Sort of like, I don't know about gun rights. I believe everyone should own a nuclear weapon.
Exactly. And when you lead with that libertarian macho flash, that very extreme position right out the gate... Number one, you're alienating the folks that are there. You're the first impression that they've ever had, and you're going to temper that impression for the rest of that person's life. And it takes a lot of work if they do encounter somebody else to kind of bring that back from the ledge. I know that there are some libertarians that like to use that because they feel that it brings people in, and it may, but it's a very small percentage. People want to have that connection that I talked about earlier, and the way that you do that is you build rapport. And one of the best ways to build rapport after you've introduced yourself and you're talking and the conversation has progressed beyond greeting is to listen. And that's one of the other things that's not happening in politics today. Because we're so quick to try to score that political point or use that bumper sticker slogan that we're programmed to use when we're talking about an issue, if we're able to listen and we're able to listen to the concerns, you can actually apply a libertarian solution to everything, to almost everything, to get an outcome that is desired. I think that we all want to have a very well-educated society. I think that we all want to have an end to homelessness. I think we all want to have people that are prosperous. I think we all want to have peace. It's just the means by which you get there. And if you are abrasive at the very beginning of that interaction, you don't have the opportunity to find out what that person's core issues are. You don't have a way to present the libertarian solution because you've turned them off right away. By the way, in describing the libertarian macho flash and that dinner party, the person who did that at that dinner party was Michael Cloud.
Really?
And he learned from that. I've done it. I've had conversations where, I'm not proud of it, but it is, it's the way that some people reach out. And unfortunately, in the libertarian world, because we are so few in the overall percentage of people, we are that first impression. And that may be what got you, but it's not going to be what gets the 97% of people who don't think in a libertarian way first.
Yeah. I don't know how much I should say here.
All of it.
About a month ago, did I mention on air or off air my mental breakdown / spiritual awakening?
You didn't, or you did
earlier
today.
Today. So the
right before the Hitler memes,
Memes, was that on air too?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Good, because that needs to really that
everybody needs to know about that.
But you delete them all.
I do because it's. I'm not gonna. I'm trying to encourage people, and you're putting Hitler on it.
They're inspirational
to some people.
Yeah.
What is the one with the tears? What does that say?
Never let the opinion of others stop you from doing what you love.
Or no, let the one where be the one that wipes away your tears, and it's like Hitler laughing.
Oh gosh, I'm not saying that one out loud.
It's awful. I just found that while I am a very functional, obviously I run a very successful podcast. I mean,
such high quality guests that you get too.
I know. Thank you for being on, Chloe.
Anytime.
And I just found that I was having trouble with some of my personal relationships, and I just realized, and I just was getting mad because after the divorce, things just kind of went crazy. And I finally sat down and thought, what's the problem? Things are not going well for me. And I'm blaming everybody else. Maybe it's me. And as I start to, as I started to take an account of my life and, talking to friends like Greg and our dear, 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 dear friend Hannah Drozich, who has a velvet touch when it comes to coaching people. She said, "No, you've really been an asshole." And I wasn't connecting with people on a real level. I was more worried about getting whatever the goal was, like instead of
likes and shares,
likes and shares and attention and all this other bull crap. And finally just decided, you know what? I'm not going to do anything. I'm not going to have goals for a little bit. And instead of like sitting here and instead of talking and waiting for one of you to finish so I can begin talking so you can hear how brilliant I am, I started to just listen. And listening to people has changed my life because it's turned it around. Instead of me interrupting, going, you know, yeah, I really struggle with this thing. Yeah, I had that too. Nobody, like, that's rude. And so I'm connecting with people on a much better level because I'm just being more authentic. I'm just being more honest. I'm not like when you try to please everybody, you end up being dishonest. Like, because you're not being honest with what you actually truly believe. And I found that through my work in the political world, I was sitting there calculating, listening to every single word, breaking down every little twitch, every little language, examining everything that the person was wearing, and trying to formulate the strategy of manipulation so that I could infiltrate your mind to persuade you to what I think you should believe. As opposed to truly just looking the person in the eye, listening to what their concerns are, and then saying, yeah, you know, well, libertarians believe. As opposed, and it's just, I think
you were waiting for your turn to speak.
Right. Waiting for my turn to speak to share maybe something that I've learned or to ask a question so I could continue to listen. And when you ask another person a question and you listen to what they have to say and then you ask a follow-up question, that's called a conversation. And libertarians a lot of times are not good at conversations. We are not good at looking you in your eye. We're not good at waiting for you to finish talking. We're waiting for you to stop talking so we can start talking at you.
Yep.
And we have, because we feel awkward, because we feel insecure in doing outreach, I found that libertarians love, I found in my candidates that they had two things, and Brett, back me up on this if you agree. They didn't think they knew enough about the libertarian philosophy, and they didn't think that they knew enough about the political process, so therefore they were not perfect messengers, and so they were afraid to act because they weren't perfect. So they were going to wait to act until they were perfect.
Oh, that's not my experience at all.
Really?
Yeah, the exact opposite.
Okay.
They felt that they were the end-all, be-all when it came to libertarian philosophy. And they felt that despite the work that has been done by those before them and the lessons that they have learned, that the person who's running still knows better.
They're the anomaly.
Right.
Yeah.
Sure.
They're the anomaly that can win it with Facebook posts.
I certainly had those people.
Right. But that was the majority that I encountered.
Yeah. The majority that I encountered were people who were just afraid to act.
Right.
And that's why I loved Melissa's. If you haven't listened to the podcast with Melissa, she's a former dominatrix. And you talk about overcoming your fear in life. These people go to Melissa and she walks them around and like they dress up like women and they cross dress and then they go to order a Coke at McDonald's. And that's the first time they've ever been in public in drag. And it releases their fear. And Melissa did it to release her own fear. And I think that's why we focused on a lot of this stuff recently, because outreach is scary. Like, you're walking up to somebody talking about...
It's a complete stranger.
It's a complete stranger, and you're talking about your deeply held personal beliefs. That's scary.
Mm-hmm.
But I think libertarians have to have more courage.
And, absolutely.
And not be afraid to say, I don't know, I don't have an answer.
Well, and that's one of the things when, you know, there are little things that you can do to help you with that. When we were at Pride earlier this year, instead of having the table at the front of the booth, we put it at the back.
Right.
You couldn't sit down. You couldn't wait for them to come to you. So you were put in the awkward position of having to stand and go to people. That was by design. It was one of the things that I tried in Georgia and worked. And it, from a data perspective, it was phenomenal. We had one of the best outreach events we've ever had. And it was because we were pushing people out of their comfort zone and pushing them to talk to others.
Now, Chloe, you've run a successful campaign. So
sure.
When you go out and persuade people, what are things that you've done to persuade others that you've seen work?
I think the biggest thing is, at least in student government, is going up to the just the random kids that are sitting at the atrium food court saying, hey, my name's so-and-so. Have you ever heard of student government before? Usually they'll say no, and you say, and that's why I want to talk to you, because you obviously have no idea that your student fees go into this co-sponsorship fee, that if you're in another organization that you can use it. Here's my card. Here's a handout. I hope you vote. And on the back, this is the platform that I'm running on, that kind of thing. It's trying
so you
to
don't
target.
Even do,
it's a nice icebreaker.
Yeah, you're not even doing...
it's not even a hard
engage,
push.
Or, yeah, it's not a hard push at all. You're not saying vote for me because I believe in this. You're saying vote for me because we're spending your money anyway.
Right, absolutely. And I think a lot of students, you know, don't understand that. And even on the national level, a lot of people, oh, my tax dollars pay for this.
So how did you sit down and figure out what you wanted to say? How did you prepare your material, prepare your speech? So when you walked up to those people, did you have an idea of what you were going to say? Had you practiced it?
I had practiced a little bit. I was fortunate that when I ran in 2013, I had a lot of experience in speech and debate from high school. But I also had a friend of mine that was going to become a speech and debate teacher that actually worked with us. And we just kind of crafted that real quick 30-second elevator speech. Because
elevator pitch.
Right. Because when you're going up to I think students especially, it's like, hey, I have 10 minutes to eat lunch and look at Facebook. Don't bother me. You know what I mean? So it turned out to be pretty handy.
So how did you decide what was the most effective message?
Oh, I think it was we're spending your money anyway.
Right.
Because when you look at students now, especially my generation is going to have what, like $30,000 in student debt, something like that.
Minimum.
Oh, minimum, right. It's very easy to come up and say, hey, did you know 663 of your dollars go to the football team? Did you know that this amount of money goes to this? So you should definitely take advantage of it. And it worked.
Did you ever get backlash to that? Because a lot of times the organization spending that money don't like the sunshine and to or that to be put under inspection. You know, they don't want that $663 to be going to the football team. Did you ever get backlash from the organizations involved? Or was there ever a counter movement almost that said, hey, our money's going towards this, and a group of students coalesced around a common cause to stop the money from going there?
I personally don't remember one, but I also think that there are a lot of students that are very lazy.
Yeah, people in general.
People in general are very lazy. I remember, I think it was last year, my senior year, it came out that there. I think the student fee that goes to the football team is around 660 some odd dollars. And I know that that was very publicized in our student media and also in our Muncie media. And I think the Star has picked it up a few times before. And there are a lot of students that are very upset about that. But hey, sports is one of the best ways to market your team.
Well, when you guys had your undefeated football season under Brady Hoke, I mean, that got Ball State on a national level that people at the time were like, where is that?
Oh, yeah,
what is that?
Absolutely.
And then sure enough, people were, I mean, everyone kind of became a fan. They wanted Ball State to be undefeated. And then before that, and that, this might have been before you were a Ball State fan, but in the early 2000s, IU's assistant basketball coach, Tim Buckley, was the basketball coach at Ball State, and they were playing in a Hawaiian tournament early with Duke, UCLA, and Kansas, and it's when Bonzi Wells was there, and they swept everybody, all top five teams, and just showed up like out of nowhere, and all of a sudden, everybody was on the Ball State bandwagon again.
Right.
And those are the two times that I can remember Ball State getting national public press. Positive, you know, I don't think you guys haven't had the issues that IU and Purdue have had of the negative national press.
No, fortunately.
Which is great. I mean, that's even more of an advantage. And then, but then though, does the student say, I don't want that money? I mean, do they even have recourse to say, I do not want 600 and some odd dollars being given?
I mean,
no?
They can complain about it on social media and they can write letters to the editor. But at the end of the day, what a lot of people don't understand is that when I was a student, I could go to any athletic event I wanted for free. Mm-hmm. If I went to an IU basketball game, it would cost me, what, $75, something like that. So at the end of the day, Ball State, I mean, I was saving money by paying that $660. And I mean, it has to come from somewhere. But
and it's basically an all-sports pass.
Right. It was an all-sports pass. And a lot of students don't understand that, hey, if you don't like it, don't go here. You can go somewhere else.
Yeah.
So how did you deal with personal rejection? So when you walk up to give your message and you inevitably get shot down or like maybe what was the worst thing somebody said to you, and then how do you deal with that?
I specifically remember first few days before our election started, before you could actually like go online and vote. And I remember seeing this girl that I had lived, like she was on my hall when I was a freshman or whatever. And I said, oh, hey, so-and-so, did you know I'm running? This is my card. And she said, oh, I'm voting for the other team. It's like, oh, kind of hit me a little hard. But at the end of the day, I kind of realized like, okay, I've got more work to do. That's one person I don't have. So now I have to make it up somehow.
And you're still alive.
I am.
You managed to make it through that tiny rejection, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you went on to win, didn't you?
I did.
Yeah. So I think sometimes we fail to put some things in perspective. So if somebody is mean to you, or if somebody turns you down or shoots you down or says, I'm a Republican, I'm not voting for your libertarian bull crap.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're all crazy conspiracy theorists. They're, you know, you're going to get rejected. You're going to have people that don't want to talk to you. You're going to have people that don't want to be bothered. But you're probably 1 out of 10 times, would you say? You're going, when you're out canvassing and talking to people in an event, you're going to have some really awesome conversations.
Oh, absolutely.
And if you get bogged down by the one bad conversation, or if you get drawn into an argument with somebody you're not going to win with, you're going to lose out on those great conversations, those people that you can convert. You know, that's it's the biblical theory of don't cast your pearls before swine. Why would you give pearls to a pig? They don't want them. They don't use them. They can't use them. They can't appreciate them. It's sinners, salvageables, and saints. You go to the saints. You inspire the saints. You go to the salvageables. You convince them. And the sinners, you leave alone. Because there's no profit in arguing with somebody who is never going to have their mind changed. And yeah, it's fun for you to sit there and argue. And sometimes there is value in arguing with people because it sharpens your sword. But for the most part, don't waste your time getting drawn into arguments if you're rejected or if they want to pick a fight. There's no point.
Well, right. as economically minded as libertarians are, we should recognize the idea of sunk costs. And there's a certain point where you do have to cut bait and you do have to end the conversation because, like Chris said, you're not going to be able to change the mind of the quote-unquote sinner.
No.
You should be focused on the salvageables. You inspire your saints, but 80 to 90% of your time should be spent on the salvageables. And, you know, there are people that you're never going to change their mind. That's fine because, you know what? Not everybody is going to become libertarian. Not everybody's going to have an idea that, oh, yes, we should be free. We should be prosperous. We should be peaceful. Things should be voluntary. That's not, there are people that that's just not going to work for them.
It's too much of a shift mentally. I mean, it's too drastic of a move. And this has a lot been candidate focused. And I think not everybody's designed to be a candidate. That's right. Not everybody's best role. You know, I see it, like we were talking before, as there's the candidate, and then there's, like, what Brett's role is, and then, you know, what your role is, the brand ambassador.
Well, I think there's a lot of people who do outreach booths that a lot of this applies to. It's not just candidates. I think if you're out giving the world's smallest political quiz at a pride parade or at whatever event, you're going to have to talk to people.
Oh, absolutely.
And you should be talking to people.
Right.
And even if that's your role, if it is a public-facing role or you're at a booth doing outreach, I think the goal of the person at the outreach booth is different than the goal of the candidate. If I'm the libertarian candidate, my goal is an external goal, really. If my goal is the outreach, it's really more about even, you know, it's tough at an outreach booth. Anytime you're trying to even get someone's attention's hard. Mm-hmm. And you're never going to get someone's attention if they come up and it isn't relevant to them.
Sure.
You know, the emphasis has to be on them. And I feel like, I mean, just even having a pamphlet of information is a bad idea because then that in and of itself is a broadcasting. You're broadcasting to them what you believe. Mm-hmm. You will get so much more attention time from that individual if you can get them to open up about what's bothering them, what's their main concern, what are their main issues. And then instead of just saying, well, this is how libertarians would fix it, you know, most people are smart enough. If you say, it's like the EPA, if you say, all right, listen, the EPA was responsible for a mistake they made and ended up releasing toxic chemicals in an abandoned mine that ended up flooding a Colorado River and is a serious issue. What, since the organization we've funded and created in order to protect us from such events has shown itself to be negligent, what is an alternative? Then you help that person, you know, start to formulate in response to that and say, well, what would you do in this case? Obviously, step one, try to prevent minerals coming into the water and toxifying your water supply. What's the proper, what are the proper protocols to do that? How would you do that? How is that done? How do we do it now? And if you can get them into a conversation about the how. So,
the Socratic method.
Yeah, the Socratic method. They're going to arrive at a totally different endpoint rather than saying, well, we'll elect politicians that appoint people to bureaucracies that can be politically influenced with money and then have different directors and overseers who have no experience in such fields. That's probably not the optimal solution to fixing the EPA.
Right.
The optimal solution is having people involved in the community that drink that water every day, that are showering in that water, that kids play in that water.
It waters their crops. It is their...
Yeah, that's a livelihood.
What we're seeing now with the Navajo Nation is they may not be able to irrigate their crops because that is the water supply, even though they're saying that it's minimal
damage,
adverse health effects.
Yeah. Right. But yeah, just like the, you know, the Gulf oil spill.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, these organizations have stopped serving their purpose. And so you have to begin to ask, why do they exist? And, you know, anytime you, like, just because it's federal government, the idea is that there are these grand overlords that are extremely smart and are the best and brightest, and that they have all the solutions that they will send to you and then have the Colorado Field Office implement, is backwards. It has to be ground up, because they're the people who have a vested interest in living there and surviving there.
One of the reasons I'm a libertarian is because, as you heard if you listened to the Abdul episode, he challenged me to defend my positions.
Mm-hmm.
And so all my Rush Limbaugh talking points didn't hold up when questioned by somebody who knew better and had more experience, more knowledge. And it starts to erode. So I think using the Socratic method, asking questions, leading, knowing the destination, but leading somebody down that path, you know, in an honest dialogue is perfectly valid. Is Chloe, is there something that you once really strongly believed that somebody else changed your perception? I mean, is there, and how did that change? So is there anything, it doesn't even have to be political if you don't have a specific political example, but I mean, is there a belief that you've held that somebody helped you see a different way, and what was the process of that?
I think probably one of the biggest ones was that, I'm trying to think, we had an instance where we had someone, speaking of trolls earlier online, we had someone that, when I ran, again, bringing up this example, just commented on something that we had on Facebook and said, hey, your page is just really bad. Like, you know, you guys, the majority of you are journalism marketing majors, but, you know, I really don't even know what you stand for. Mm-hmm. And it was one of those things where I had to message that person and say, okay, I know you're a student, and this person, I had no idea who he was. And he actually met with us after I engaged him a little bit, became friends with him, and he came to all of our debates and said, okay, this is how you have to end up marketing yourself. So it was one of those things where I had to take a step back and say, hey, you kind of have to listen to other people, and especially... Right. You know, just be humble about it.
Yeah. Be willing to change.
Oh, yeah.
What about you?
I
know you're always right.
Always. Chloe always
was,
have been.
Chloe was complaining about that before you got here.
Yeah, that's fine. You know, I am always right. No, I actually did have an evolution of my position, changing sides on immigration. Mm-hmm. I was very much a closed borders person. And it took
hilarious considering that your family was an immigrant, a family that immigrated here like not even what 70 years ago.
Right. Right. Yes. My grandfather was an anchor baby. Yes.
Right.
That's true. I did hold at one time a very closed borders view. And it took seeing someone's personal relationship, that I worked with and I was friends with. His boyfriend was from China and could not come here other than for education. He had all kinds of degrees because he was continuing to get education visas and stays so that he could get more degrees, but no one was willing to sponsor him to work. And at the time in Georgia, there was a nursing shortage, and he was a nurse, but he couldn't find a job because nobody was willing to sponsor his visa for him to work here, because you have to sponsor them you basically have to guarantee that for the entire time they're here that you will employ them.
Right.
And it wasn't something that could be easily fixed by marrying someone, because it was two dudes. At that time, that wasn't something that was happening in Georgia, and I'm honestly surprised that we haven't seen more pushback on the marriage license thing there like we have in Kentucky. But at the end of the day, I saw the struggle. I got to know Scott. And he ended up moving to Canada because they have a much easier
immigration
system and, you know, back and forth.
You hear that, listeners? Move to Canada because they're better than us.
But it was a situation.
Son of a bitch.
It was a situation where he couldn't go back to China. Being gay, they would kill him.
Yep.
That was the part.
That's bad time.
Right. So your choices are.
That's a good reason not to go back to China.
Exactly. So he could go back to China and die.
With their polluted rivers and everything.
He could try to continue his education, you know, continue more while he waited to get something, you know, try to find a job. And but at the end of the day, he had to move to Canada, and their relationship didn't survive that move. But I got to see it firsthand, and it took probably 3 months of seeing it in person. And having that connection to somebody who's facing something that I was absolutely dead set against, that changed the way that I looked at it and said, you know what? There is a reason to have freedom of movement, not just in goods, but also in labor. Looking at it from a very libertarian, you have a right of freedom to travel. Ernie Hancock is right. The answer is always freedom. What was the question?
I think for me, more than anything, as what has changed my political viewpoints is just getting older and becoming more mature and accepting that we're all human beings and shedding off all these preconceived notions. And, you know, I've talked about this before. Maya was a huge influence on me over the last 2 or 3 years of seeing somebody struggle against just false constructs of society, as Maya would say. You know, somebody who is trying to just be an individual, live their life in the way that they see fit, and is punished because other people have, they think that that person, that Maya ought to
live.
That's
not the way it's done.
Right. That's not how we do it. And, you know, we are so quick to live other people's lives and to let our family expectations or political expectations or church expectations or whatever mold what we want to do. I mean, that's part of freedom, is personal freedom, and it is political freedom. It's being free in every area of your life. And as I have come to understand that, becoming a libertarian really helped me see that. Because before that, when I was a Republican, I really wanted to control everybody. I wanted to be that central planner. I wanted to guide people to the best outcomes in their life. And as I have become a libertarian, I have learned to love and appreciate what it means to be an individual, not only within myself, but also within other people. And Maya and I don't share values in certain areas, but I love Maya nonetheless, and I want her to live the life that she wants to live.
Yeah, and not be punished for,
sure,
for personal choice.
And just having empathy for other people. We're going to have someone on who, you know, like with Woody, in episode 91 of the show, you hear Woody's story and you feel the pain of losing his daughter at the hands of a government that doesn't care, that lacks all humanity. 100 people came into contact with his daughter, and one person spoke up and said, "Your daughter's dying, you need to do something." And it took 2 weeks for him to finally get to Rachel, and by that point, she had passed away. We're going to have somebody on who is a victim of domestic violence here in the next 2 or 3 episodes. And the government does nothing but punish them, the victims, and hurt them. And they're not there to protect the family. They're not even there to protect the perpetrator. They're just there for bureaucratic red tape so everybody can look like they've done something, but people are being hurt. And I think as I have started to, what shaped my point of view more than anything was being the executive director of the Libertarian Party of Indiana, and then being somebody who is in a public role as a libertarian, and hearing people's stories and talking to people about the true cost of government and feeling that within my soul. and saying something is deeply wrong here and we've got to do something about it because it's broken and it's hurting people. And government does not help people. It is hurting people when you actually get down to talking to people about their stories.
Yeah, and then it's not, it was, and that was its intent. I mean, that's not the case at all. You know, government was, necessarily created to, so everyone had the explicit guarantee to get out of a bad situation or to have a hand up or, you know, that last line of protection. And it's any, like anything, though, like society turns things into an abstract. When you're not engaged in your community on that level, that personal level where you see the pain or you experience the heartbreak or you experience the domestic violence, it turns into, okay, well, that's where we have government, so that person has, you know, can get out of that scenario. And that turns it into an abstract thing instead of something you live and experience. And the ultimate result, though, is resentment, especially when you get into a place like now where we spend so much on it and we commit so many resources to it that are ineffective or end up being resources spent for a problem that doesn't exist, that is ultimately taken care of in churches, communities, families, that type of place. There's a resentment that grows by the people funding it. And so then that turns into a villainization of us versus them. Mm-hmm. And then it's rare to encounter the moderate today. You know, we've become very, very isolated in the information we take in and then the analysis we choose to read and accept is correct. And so you have people you don't even identify with whatsoever, but purely because you're politically affiliated with one party or the other. And like with the libertarians, that's why I know Brett, when Brett ran for school council, you guys repaired a bench, right? There was a bench or a park. I thought you did something.
You remember that one time you did a good thing?
Oh, there may have been more than one time. One of the things that we did.
Humble brag.
We did school supplies.
Yeah, and a school book drive. Supplies.
We did school supplies and a book drive. I saw through my work with the school board that literacy was a big issue. And it was access to books that was the problem. In the ward where I was, it was the poorest ward in the city from a socioeconomic perspective. And it wasn't a matter of, and this is going to be hilarious to Chris, but it wasn't a matter of how many books were in the home. It was how many homes per book.
Okay.
I mean, Chris has just unloaded his library. I don't know if he's talked about that a lot or a little.
We've talked about it. I've sold off all my books.
But it was a situation where it wasn't like, well, there's 100.
I can't read, Chloe.
Oh, good to know.
It wasn't a situation where there were 100 books per household. It was that there were
six houses,
17
per
houses per book. And to me, I saw an opportunity for us to help. And what we did was we had a book drive and it was all voluntary, but it was something that I had seen. It was an issue that in talking with the principal and talking with the teachers, and it's that, you know, hey, and we timed it around Christmas. So it was something that the kids could take home so they would have access to something for those 2 to 3 weeks, because otherwise they wouldn't.
Yep.
Yeah. And that's, if you've read Outliers, and they were talking about why Malcolm Gladwell is talking about why that's a good book.
It's a good book.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a great book. And they're talking about why poor, low income families versus high income families, the education rates are different. It's not because the rich white kids are smarter and the poor black kids are dumber. It's because the parents have the resources to continue their education in times like Christmas break, like summer vacation, whereas the low-income families have working parents and they can't get to it. They don't have the time and they don't have the resources.
Right. They're too focused on making the ends meet so that there's a roof over their head and, oh, if they get to read, then awesome.
Every human being is, you know, it's about starting out. It's not about starting out. It's, I don't know. Sometimes our view is we view, we compare everything. It's always comparison. It's like, we look at it and we go, well, poor means dumb. So,
oh, yeah, guilt by association.
But then we got to take care of them because they're poor and dumb.
Yeah, well, then, yeah, the liberal entitlement, we know better. And
social justice warrior, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so you were saying something about Brett and...
Well, I was going to say, like, with libertarians in general, I've always thought, you know, it's pointless to go out. I mean, it's pointless to go out and shake hands and say, this is what I believe because I'm a libertarian. You know, it's a way better use of resources to say, we're going to rebuild that house in this, you know, rundown community where we have several supporters, or we are going to have a libertarian food truck that goes around. You can deliver anytime someone in the neighborhood's having a crisis. Mm-hmm. You know, being by showing that it can be done without an agency or oversight, and you can fill in the gaps, and that the Libertarian Party is that filling in of the gap where we don't have to have a license from the government to help somebody, and that it can be relied upon even though there isn't the explicit guarantee of government.
It's almost like Greg listened when I was on the Lava Flow podcast where I was talking about walking the walk.
Yep.
Where you have to show...
I was going
to
say it's like he's listening to Jesus, take care of your fellow man, but okay, you go ahead and compare yourself to Jesus.
Hey now, you're the one that's making that comparison. But that was actually one of the things that we did talk about when I was on, and we're so quick to outsource responsibility because we see it, and Greg mentioned the key word for me earlier, it's intent. Somebody has a great idea, they think it's going to help society, they get the law passed or they get the ordinance done, or they, you know, the beginning of that solution starts and they think they're done. Libertarians look beyond that. We look at the outcomes. We look at what's going to happen. We look at, okay, well, it's going to help this person, but it's going to hurt these six people because they're involved.
The hidden costs.
And so we're looking at those underlying factors, and it really does come to an intent versus outcome. And Friedman was one who talked about that quite a bit, where he talked about how you can't judge something just based on someone's intent. You actually have to see it through. And so when you show, like Greg was talking about, and you're walking the walk, like I talk about a lot, you are that shining libertarian example, then you can point to your peaceful, voluntary solution that involved no coercion, no force, and most importantly, no government.
No paperwork.
To provide a solution to a real life, real world issue for an individual, a family, a neighborhood, a community, a town, a county, a state, a nation. You can make that difference, but you have to be able to show, you have to be able to point to the things that can be done in the absence of government. But because we are so quick to outsource that responsibility to government, we celebrate when there's a law that's passed that takes care of supposedly
no child left behind.
No child left behind, yeah. or the way that they have the Amber Alerts.
Yep.
You know, that's supposed to say, that was supposed to be the panacea, and it was going to end all of our searching for kidnapped children.
Mm-hmm.
And we're now it happens so frequently that we turn off the alerts and we stop looking and we stop caring because
it's an abstract.
Somebody else is doing it.
Yeah.
There's a system in place. We don't have to worry about it anymore.
I'm sure they're very smart and they'll have it handled.
When you hear the stories, and I've lived this story, unfortunately, and when you hear the story of the person we're going to have on, the Department of Children's Services is meant to save children. Hmm. And it does nothing but put children at risk and hurt them. And it serves no purpose. It should be abolished. And there is no doubt in my mind about it. So I think in all of this, what it comes down to is, as a libertarian, you have to love the individual. First, you have to love yourself as an individual and do what you want to do as long as you're not hurting other people. Be free to live your life as you want to live your life as long as you're not hurting other people. It's when you start hurting others that it becomes a problem. Next, you have to start loving other individuals and connecting with them and talking with them. I lived in a bubble. I isolated myself. I was married, so it was kind of like a protective cocoon. Greg was there. He knows. Not in the marriage. We weren't married, Chloe, with each other. It was just...
Oh, okay.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
But you can now, luckily.
Yeah.
And but I just... I lived my life from a mountaintop where I was right and I told how everybody else how they should live and it should be freedom. Well, that doesn't make any sense. And over the last couple of years, I've learned to love being an individual and connecting with other individuals. And as I have done that, my politics has changed, my personal life has changed, everything about me has changed. I'm a happier person because I'm truly connecting with others. When you One of the things that I have learned is that it is wonderful to be listened to. I have never grown more because I have so many great friends that just listen to me. And they don't try to fix my problems. They just give me encouragement and they listen. And so many people in the voting public, when you go out and do outreaches, they just want to be listened to. They want to vent their frustration about the political. They don't want you to interrupt with the solution unless they ask for a solution. They want to talk and vent and get it out. And they just want you to listen because they're so tired of not being listened to, because they're so tired of getting spit lines back in their face and all the bull crap that these congressional candidates are. They just want to be heard. And if you're the person that is listening and they feel like you care, you know, Woody came to us because Woody felt like Rupert would listen to him and Woody would care. And then when I picked up the phone and I started talking to Woody, I wasn't afraid to hear his story. I wasn't afraid to connect with Woody. I wasn't afraid to talk him through this issue, give him advice, and then have him come on. And he wasn't afraid to tell his story. It's a deeply emotional story for him. It's very difficult for Woody to tell his story. And I thank God that he has the courage to do that, because people like Woody will change the system. Because when you hear Woody's story, you feel it in your soul, as opposed to hearing him in a three-minute soundbite on the 11 o'clock news, and you're sitting there going, man, somebody really should do something about that. That sounds horrible. And we've delegated that responsibility to somebody else ought to do something. And, you know, the Christian church, our faith groups, Jewish organizations, they're as guilty. I'm a Christian, so it is. Let me talk about my people. If you give over responsibility for caring, liberal Christians, and I'm a Methodist, so trust me, I've got my own issues with people, with my church. But they want to look at the government and say, this is the compassionate solution. And you know what that does? That means that you are just writing a check to the government and letting them not take care of the problem, as opposed to going out and showing love to other human beings. So if you want to be good at outreach, you first have to love the individual. You have to start listening to people. You have to start connecting with others, asking them questions, and having an experience with somebody else. Put down your cell phone. You know, and there's this big race to have like all this technology for outreach. What's the best way that we can connect with people? How many apps can we build? It's not about apps. You know, exactly. Brett did a book drive.
Yep.
Because when Brett actually had the courage to get up off of his enormous fat ass and to get out there and start talking to people, Brett recognized a need in his own community because he had the courage to get out and act. And he wasn't afraid to do it. And then he saw a need. And then he started telling people about the need. And then other people felt like, oh, wow, this really sucks. I can do something. Because Brett broke it off into small bite-sized pieces. I don't need you to come up with 1,300 books.
Right.
I need 5 books from you.
Yep.
And 5 books from your neighbors. Mm-hmm. And spread the word on your Facebook. And start spreading it that way. Break it down into sizable pieces. And through that action, Brett was able to make new friends, connect to people, and give people a good perception of what it means to be a libertarian and what it means to be a good person. Not that you're a good person, Brett, but you at least give the impression.
You know, it's all about perception.
It's all about pleasing people. So I think that's really what it comes down to. And I know that this is probably one of our more Oprah episodes, but I don't think that you can...
Wait, are we all getting a car?
Oh, my God, yes.
You get a car, and you get a car,
I hope so.
Get a car.
She's 23. I know she needs a car.
Yes.
So, I think from all of our experiences, there is no other way than to connect with people on a real level and just listen to them. I think that's the best way to do outreach. There is no other real way. You know, we could sit here and tell you go to advocates.org, advocates.org, and buy lots and lots of materials.
Yes.
That Chloe will write you a note in every single box that she ships you.
Yep.
Buy them now.
If you are a We Are Libertarians listener and you actually do order something, let them know. Let's make Chloe work, all right?
Yeah, please.
Well, she just took the quiz today, right?
No.
No, previously.
And you took the quiz and scored libertarian for the first time?
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember, like, roughly how pure you were? Like, what your percentage points were?
Are you a 100-100?
No, I don't remember. I don't think I paid attention to that. I
you just
take
saw
it
you
again.
Were libertarian?
I just looked at the little chart.
Okay.
Trap.
Well, that's good enough. And then you recently spoke about or wrote about the EPA.
I did.
About the spill. What are your thoughts on that situation?
Well, it's pretty terrible. And I think it's pretty ironic that the organization, kind of like you mentioned, that is built to protect our wildlife and to make sure that we don't have pollutants in our water and in our riverways, has royally screwed it up for people in that area. And, you know, when I think about the Navajo Nation and, you know, taking care of their children, I see a lot of, you know, women that are making bottles for their babies or that can't do it now because that water's contaminated. And mm-hmm. I just think it's a shame. And it's literally $381 million in taxpayer money that's turned to sludge now.
What exactly happened for those of us who may or may not have read the news?
It was an abandoned
yes
abandoned
yes.
mine, and it was contaminated and sealed off with a dam. Lots of arsenic, tons of minerals. I mean, it turned everything into sludge that it touched. Mm-hmm. And they had been warned not to tamper with the dam, mm-hmm. and they ended up tampering with it, and it spilled into the.
And it was actually a contractor for the EPA.
Yeah, it was a contractor for the EPA.
I saw that everybody had their jimmies rustled over the fact that they weren't going to find themselves. But let's be honest, why would the EPA find itself? That just means we're paying ourselves
right.
or whatever.
Right.
Like they're not finding themselves. Hypocrisy at its finest. But, what are they going to do? Steal more money from me to pay?
But there has to be some sort of accountability measure,
right?
You know, we've talked about intent versus outcome. The intent of the EPA is to protect us from all the things that Chloe talked about and that Greg talked about. But the outcome is they have done a terrible job in this particular instance and in others where they aren't necessarily taking the correct action. They're taking the built action for them. And the problem that we run into is one-size-fits-all solutions when we are all individuals who all make different decisions. You know, we've all heard human action. That's exactly what it all comes down to. It's the decisions that we make every day, and we're all going to make different choices based on our life experience and what we're facing. And one-size-fits-all solutions don't do that. And when you're part of a nation that's 300 million-plus people, it's very difficult to have a one-size-fits-all solution. As somebody who did see how that policy worked in the education world, can you really say that every kid that was born within 12 months of each other in the same zip code has the exact same needs? Because I don't think that's the case. I know that's not the case because I can see, even in my house, the differences between my sister and myself when it came to education. We do the same thing when we outsource that responsibility to the government. And with regard to the EPA, and we're affecting other people by having outsourced that to the government because we're now not protecting the people that they were supposed to protect. So the outcome is worse by having them involved.
Well, yeah, like the contractor in question is based out of Missouri.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so clearly it's not someone that's, you know, living there. They're going to be drinking off that water. They're going to be dealing with all this, you know, the cleanup and the detoxification that's going to have to be done. And you know, you say, well, what do? You can't find the EPA.
Right.
Can't. You're just spending, you know, you're finding yourself. But there has to be some accountability, and the form of the accountability will ultimately end up taking the loss of contract for that company.
There will be somebody who signed a piece of paper that authorized
the
contract
they'll still get paid because they'll challenge it in court legally.
Right.
And then the court, because they're constructed by the law, will say, well, technically, by the terms of the agreement, they are still entitlement to pay. I can't let the $500 million you're going to have to spend in cleanup affect the ability of this contract that was made in good faith. But that the EPA, regardless that they outsourced it to a contractor, should lose their authority in that area. I mean, you can't continue to trust that organization to act on your behalf, even for your drinking water, when their track record is clearly to not care. I mean,
but
mistakes happen all the time, but they'd been warned. And they still, regardless, a mistake happened, and it's such a critical mistake. I think that if I were the governor of Colorado, on behalf of the citizens, I would send the National Guard and shut down the EPA's field office, and then I would
Might want to do it in New Mexico, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would actually say that clearly the federal government has lost the authority since they are no longer protecting what we have entrusted to them, and make it a political standoff, because that's what we need. Until it is taken from the federal level and centralized to decentralized, you'll never get better outcomes.
Well, but here's
and that
part
goes
of
all the way down to the community level.
Here's one of the flaws of government. Chloe, do we expect people to be perfect?
Absolutely not.
Right. Is government made of people?
Absolutely.
Do we expect the government to be perfect?
The majority of the time.
Right. It's flawed logic. How can any organization from a board, any organization from two people up, one person up, it's not going to be perfect. Nothing will ever be perfect. Mistakes will be made. But, you know, we expect perfection. It's when we look at the EPA, we go, how could they screw this up? They're supposed to be perfect. They're the ones protecting us. How could a mistake be made? And so we have given those expectations. I guess what I'm trying to say, if I could get my point out, is we're creating false expectations.
Yeah.
We're creating an expectation that some Superman organization can fix all the problems of the world when it's made of flawed human beings.
Well, and Gary Johnson brought this up during his campaign. The government is trying to do so much.
Right.
That it does so much so poorly.
Mm-hmm.
Because there should be things. Everybody has an expertise. But we all know jacks of all trades who aren't really masters of anything.
Right.
And so you don't hire the handyman to build your house. You hire the handyman to fix the hinge.
Right.
You hire the handyman for what he can do, but we're hiring the handyman to do everything.
Yeah.
And we're not doing it voluntarily. We're doing it through force.
Yeah.
And, you know, until it changes, I mean, this won't outrage people enough to demand the shutdown of the Colorado field office of the EPA, but it should.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing the EPA does that a community council couldn't do.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I mean, they don't do anything groundbreaking. They don't do anything. You have the Colorado School of the Mines in Colorado. Why would you hire somebody from the federal government in Washington, D.C.?
That's a great point.
You know,
My cousin went to school in Boulder, and he's like a mineralogist, and he's going to, like, he's getting major contracts to go out in Nigeria and drill for oil because he's like this crazy smart geological guy, and Boulder is one of those. Why would you hire somebody from Missouri? Nobody from Missouri is smart.
No, I mean,
okay, that's an exaggeration.
But yeah, like that's to entrust it to the grand overlords who are, you know, there's such a misconception that there are so many smart people in D.C. There's a lot of attorneys, a lot of people that could pass the bar, you know, and they are good at maybe crafting law or glad handing private business in order to secure and procure government contracts, but they're not experts in their field. And so we have to stop this idea that, you know, ever since Kennedy, it was that the best and brightest are in government, and we are the ones we've been waiting for with Barack Obama, and hope and change. And if we just get the right, intelligent, capable people into government, we can fix everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I have never met someone in government that I've thought that person is so capable.
Even when you go back, to the founding, you see that there are people that were flawed, people that made compromises, people that made decisions that today you look back on it and you say, how could they have thought that? How could they have decided that was the way to go? One of the other things
I ask that of Brett's parents all the time.
All the time.
How could you conceive such a child?
Yes, yes. But we see all the time that people get frustrated with the government. And one of the things that we see a lot of frustration, people don't know how to respond when they have that frustration. We see it now reoccurring in Ferguson after we saw it a year ago. Part of the movie that I saw last night, Straight Outta Compton, talked about the Rodney King riots and what happened, the things that are there. These are people that don't understand how they can have their voice heard. And everybody looks at it as not everybody. There are people that look at it like, how could they possibly do this in their own community? They're just so frustrated that they don't understand how they can get their grievances redressed.
No, because they can't use the traditional forms.
Because they've already seen that it's failed.
So they're not going to go down that route. So they go the only other route is to burn it all down.
Right.
And like in Ferguson, 21,000 residents. 16,000 outstanding warrants for citizens of Ferguson.
That's insane.
It is incredible.
Say that one more time.
21,000 residents, 16,000 outstanding warrants.
And how many of those go back to the...
Oh, they're 10 years old.
They're tickets for taillights out.
Oh, it's
out
all
and,
for...
And all of the stuff where they've missed a court date because they had this and that.
Couldn't afford the traffic
couldn't
ticket.
Couldn't afford the ticket, and so they couldn't afford the probation. Yeah.
If you want to, look like you want to say something, you just jump in.
No, I was floored by that. I didn't know that statistic.
And like,
it's
so
crazy.
I would burn the place down too if, you know, over 3/4 of my fellow citizens were under arrest if they got pulled over for going through a red light.
Let's put that into human terms. That means that at least in a 4-person family, what, 2, 3?
3.
Yeah.
3 or more.
Of the people at this table right now would have outstanding warrants.
I'm guessing it's not Chloe.
Probably
No.
It's
yeah.
Greg probably has the majority of them.
Yeah.
It's
crazy.
Yeah. So I mean, you think about that. You say, well, if they can't take political action, because should they embrace it and go into the public sphere, they're going to be arrested.
Right.
Should they exercise their voting right, or should they exercise their right to complain about a street lamp that's out? Anytime any interaction with the federal government will result in their arrest.
Or any level of government.
They live under occupation.
Mm-hmm. That's a great point.
They really do. And so there can't be trust in government. And yet you have... What drives me crazy is they affiliate with the party. And they vote for the party and turn out for the party that wants to... That believes that we can fix government and make it more efficient and better and less bureaucratic and get the best and
brightest.
They vote
for Republicans?
All right. I mean,
the Republicans, regardless, aren't the... They don't... speak highly of government.
Anytime, well, in a place like Ferguson, in a place like a major city, you're going to have entrenched one-party rule, and that's never good. It doesn't matter if it's Republicans, Democrats, even if Libertarians were the only party in power, that would be bad. And I think it's almost like we have to start looking at it. When you say that, it's almost like the broken window...
fallacy.
Not the broken window's fallacy. The policing that Mayor Giuliani instituted in the 90s, where if you see a broken window, then you should investigate it because that's where crime will be. I forget what it was called.
Yeah, it's like the community cleanup. And so if we don't have broken windows, we don't have crime.
So if we start going after the little small petty offenses, then that will lead to major busts. And it really did help turn New York City around. But in so many ways, like that's the way that they are, they being the broad term for the big scary government and all of it and all the people therein. That's almost how the enslavement happens, man. I mean, I sounded like Chris Peffers. That's how the enslavement happens, man. Pass the dube. But
you carry that on to stop and frisk.
Right.
You exactly. See somebody who looks suspicious because you're operating under this broken window idea that if we fix the broken window, we investigate what happens there, we find the small petty offense. Okay, so then when you found all that, you still have that mindset. And so now you're going... Well, they look like they might be up to something, so we're going to stop them, or we're going to frisk them because we might find something, or we're going to stop this car because the license plate light is out. And we know from experience that what we'll be able to do is we'll be able to find warrants, or we'll find drugs in the car, or we'll find contraband or whatever, and they have the perverse incentive of doing good when in actuality they're terrorizing people over simple, for the most part, simple and honest mistakes.
Yes, and no one's harmed by no one's harmed by that. And
that's not true. I actually looked through, and when examining victimless crime, mm-hmm. there are victims. It's the taxpayers that have to fund the incarceration and the kangaroo court that they go through. That's the actual
victim. The victim is yourself. Yeah. Right. There is no free lunch, I guess, even in petty crime. I don't know, it's past the point of what you even do. I mean, if I lived in Ferguson, the only option's moving. And most of them can't. So, right. Or they can, but not really.
You become Detroit. Sorry, I'm eating a turnover.
Yeah. This has you so upset and so riled up. The plight of the Ferguson citizen affects Chris Fangle so deeply that he needs a blueberry scone.
I'm pushed off. Delicious.
Well, I think we've done enough doom and gloom for
these
today.
These are delightful.
See?
I feel bad for all the people in Ferguson.
That are not eating those apple turnovers right now.
In their food desert. With no apple turnovers. Terrible. Does that mean that you guys want to end?
We should probably wrap up, I believe.
Okay. So, at the end of every episode, we get the opportunity
to rant. You can say whatever you'd like. If you want people to follow you, if you want to self-promote and get a point in, the floor is yours. We're going to go to Brett first. It's just open season talk. We'll go to Brett first. Brett?
I'd like for people who haven't yet, take the world's smallest political quiz.
You should do that.
Theadvocates.org/quiz. Come visit. See political tendency. It's a ruler. It measures your political tendency. It's not going to tell you that you are this or you are that. It's going to say this is what your political beliefs tend to align with. Use that information to figure out where you want to go. You may find that you're surprised by the outcome. From a personal perspective, you know, follow me on Twitter. It's at Brett Bittner. Follow me on Facebook. It's facebook.com/Bittner for Liberty. Those are the things that I do to share some of the ideas that I have and thoughts that I have. I do post a lot of the things that I've written there, talking intent versus outcome, outsourcing responsibility, walking the walk, those kind of things. Those are the things that I'm talking about all the time. If that was something that struck you today in listening, that's stuff that I'm always talking about.
Spell your name, please.
Brettbittner. There are two T's in the first and last, and there's only one R in the last name, and it's at the end.
Social Security number, go.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
Chloe?
I think Brett touched very well on the whole taking the world's smallest political quiz, but we're running a special right now on some of our books on the advocates.org website. Just click store. If you buy a book, I will write you a note. Just, you know, put that in the comments and I will write one for you. And everyone just have a safe and happy weekend.
All right. Very good. Thank you for coming on, by the way.
Thank you for having me. This was fun.
All right. And Greg?
Political update, I guess. The Donald has dominated. Is dominating. He's taking the lead in Iowa from Scott Walker.
Oh, my gosh.
He is taking the lead in New Hampshire from Jebby. I mean, he is sweeping America in a way that America deserves. He is amazing. Also, look for Chris Christie to drop out of the race by August. It's the rumor. He's out of
Rick
money. Rick Perry's going to drop out soon. He can't pay his staffers anymore. And then John Kasich isn't fundraising like I thought he would after the debates, and we both kind of thought he'd run up on the polls.
And Carly is on fire.
Carly's on fire.
That girl's on fire.
She's the smart Bachman and Palin. She can actually defend herself and is intelligent. Rand has decided to play nerd at the lunch table, standing up to the schoolroom bully, to Donald Trump.
That'll be my final point.
What?
Rand Paul.
Oh, are you wrestled?
I'm about done. Go ahead. Continue.
I thought it was a good strategic move. And then the Iran deal, the other thing, main thing to watch out. Don't listen to all the Republicans that the Iranians are the second coming of the Gestapo and the SS. Support it.
It's an army of Toyotas in the desert, guys.
And there is no better deal that can be done. There's this fallacy that better deal can be negotiated at Kant. This is the best thing on the table.
If you want peace, you give people economic freedom.
Yep. It is the best and most likely agreement we've had in a long time that would... It'll actually make the Middle East safer. Now, Israel say it doesn't, but that's not true. Yeah. The worst thing that can happen for Israel is for Iran to get the nuclear weapon, because then they will attack Iran and the Arab states will unite against Israel. So they have a vested interest in pursuing the slowing down of any pursuit of nuclear weapons. Now let's hear your Jimmy's, Russell. And thanks, Chloe, and thanks, Brett, for coming on.
Thanks, Chloe, for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
And thanks for having me, too.
You're welcome. I think I'm, you know, as I reexamine life and I sit in my rocking chair on my porch and drink my mint julep and smoke my cigar and then write... right next to Walden Pond, I guess, is what I'm up to. I really just think it's time to be honest and say I don't like Rand Paul. I think he's kind of a jerk. I think he is inauthentic and full of crap. And I get the feeling, unlike his dad, who says exactly what he believes to his detriment sometimes, I feel like Rand Paul is trying to tell me what I want to hear. And I don't know that I can trust him. And I don't know that I'm willing to support a politician that I can't trust and that I don't think is actually authentic or real. I believe most of what he believes. I think he's definitely the best candidate in the Republican field.
But I don't know that I can trust him with power because I don't trust him personally. And so I mean,
gut feeling.
Yeah. And I felt this, and I've said this over and over and over, but it just keeps getting stronger and stronger. It's like the fighting with Donald Trump. It's like that strategy. He's all about strategy. He's not necessarily about principle. So I don't know. I'm not going to be shocked.
Are you calling somebody out for not being pure?
No, I'm not saying that he's not pure. I'm saying that he's probably full of shit. There's a difference.
You really doubt that he has different political beliefs than his father?
I really don't know.
Even though his father told you he believes the exact same thing to your face?
I have very different political beliefs from mine.
No, but I asked him.
Yeah, he said it straight to my face.
Ron did. So now you're saying Ron's full of shit, too.
Ron's old and cranky. He may not know what he was saying. I mean, right? Yeah. So, I don't know.
I think you just don't like somebody, and you're just not going to vote for him.
Yeah, what's wrong with that?
Nothing.
There's nothing wrong with that.
No, but I mean, I wouldn't try to justify it.
This is America, goddammit. This is freedom. I'm free. I can do what I want.
You just want to vote for the Donald. You're looking for any excuse to vote for the Donald.
I am. I'm looking for any excuse to vote for pure authenticity, Donald Trump.
Oh, he's beautiful.
Again, I say this at the end of every episode. Have you looked up histrionic personality disorder? Because the Donald is a textbook case. All right. Well, this has been an episode. It had Brett on it, so next time we can do better, right?
I enjoy Bittner.
I know. I like having Chloe on. I like Chloe more, but Bittner, you're all right.
Well, you know. Hey, at least now you know that I'll listen to two episodes because I'll listen to the niece one, too.
Yeah, because you want to hear what he said about you.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's at the end. It's like the 50-minute mark.
Of course it is. Well, I'll just ask him tonight.
Ask him. Pretend you've heard it and troll him a little bit. No, it's at like the 55-minute mark is when he gets into it. I edited out the part where he called you a dick.
Well, you know.
Because I just felt like that wasn't very nice.
Everyone's entitled to their own opinion.
Right.
I don't believe that. I vote Republican most of the time, so I don't believe that at all.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us here on We Are Libertarians. We appreciate you joining us on this episode. And as always, we promise
to do better next time.